Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this second session. My name is Chris Decker, and I am an economist who works in the area of the utilities, and included in that area is obviously water. And so I've been following for a number of years now questions about the regulation of water and the prospects for competition for water, etc., both in the UK and in a prior life in Australia. So I'm very glad that I've been asked to chair this session. Before we get into the session, I think when we start to talk about water markets and water trading and water sharing, for me, it raises something of a puzzle. Because on the one hand, the idea of water markets and water trading is not a new idea. It's been happening in parts of the US since the late 1970s, in Chile in 1981. You had ideas of water rights. In Australia, there were obviously systems of water sharing and water trading since about the 1980s. And I think, as John's going to talk about, there's obviously transfers of bulk water happening in England and Wales. And so at the same time, we have some experience of water trading, but we also have, I think, fairly clearly, the intellectual case for water trading and water markets being put out there in the 1990s. Cases of what were called free market environmentalism, I think, is the term that's being used, the idea that the market and environmental concerns can come together and in some way or another facilitate the efficient trading of water and sharing of water. But nevertheless, I think the puzzle is this. It's not widespread. It's unlike other areas of the utilities where you've seen, developments in one country being mirrored or copied in other ways. This hasn't happened in water to the same extent. And I think there are a number of answers for that. One answer could be that it's simply not been an issue to date, except in hot countries like Chile or Australia or etc. But I think it could also be other factors, and some of those factors might be some of the issues that we're discussing today about reconciling, if you like, the market with stewardship concerns and ideas of defining rights. So I think that, to me, there is a bit of a puzzle as to why the benefits, if you like, of trading have been recognised by both environmentalists and economists for quite a period now, and yet we haven't quite seen it take off to some extent. So with those sort of introductory comments, I'm very much looking forward to this session where we're going to get three perspectives on what's happening here in England and Wales in terms of the development of water markets and water trading.
Okay. So my presentation today is going to be addressing the question, could trade in water resources promote water stewardship approaches? So first of all, I thought it would be useful just to think about exactly what we mean by water stewardship, because it's one of those phrases that's widely used and not often defined, and it's kind of a catch-all that can mean everything to everybody. So I think this was the most comprehensive definition that I could find, which is from the Alliance for Water Stewardship. And so stewardship itself is the idea about taking care of something that we don't own, and because when we're talking about public goods, because everybody is responsible for their sustainable management, stewardship approaches should be based on collective responses. And then when you go on to look at water stewardship specifically, it's the use of fresh water that is socially and economically beneficial as well as environmentally sustainable. So just quickly, I won't go on this for too long, but what does water stewardship mean to us at Anglian Water? Well, the scale of the challenges facing water resources in our region means that it's right at the centre of our business and of our activity. So the Anglian region is the driest in the country, and it's also one of the fastest growing regions. The Environment Agency has classified most of the catchments in the region as having no new water available. Because of this, we today supply the same amount of water today as we did in 1989, and despite a 25% increase in the number of households in the region. So looking at abstraction in the Anglian region, you can see that whereas public water supply is the majority abstractor, we are just one of a community of abstractors, and we're not the only person taking water, abstracting water from the environment. So although we are the majority abstractor, other sectors have a significant presence, most notably agriculture. So over a quarter of wheat and barley crops and over half of sugar beet and a third of potato crops grown in England and Wales are actually grown in the Anglian region. And the biggest demand for spray irrigation in England and Wales is, again, in the Anglian region. And agriculture abstractions, the majority of which are spray irrigation, account for less than 5% of the total water resources abstracted, but they have a disproportionate large effect on the catchment because they're abstracted at the driest months of the year. So we feel that in order to ensure that water resources are sustainable, we need a cross-sectoral approach to a cross-sectoral problem. So in 2011, we published a report with Frontier Economics looking at a right to water and the current abstraction regime. And the report identified four principles for sustainable water allocation, which are listed there. And the report concluded that generally, the current regime does protect the environment and other in-stream users, and it does ensure affordable and reliable public water supplies. But what it doesn't do is to encourage the efficient allocation of water, and it doesn't encourage dynamic efficiency. So just thinking back to the definition of water stewardship being the use of fresh water that is socially and economically beneficial as well as environmentally sustainable, you can see that there is scope for improvement. And the report concluded that trading could make more water more economically beneficial because it is a better means of reallocating water to those who value it most. So it would encourage low-value users to release their water to high-value users. It was also adaptable, and it reveals the value of water. So this is all fine in theory, but what does it actually mean in practice, and is it actually feasible? Which leads me on to talk about the Cambridge Programme for Sustainability Leadership Project on Sustainable Water Allocation. So CPSL has launched a collaboratory on water stewardship. One of the work streams was sustainable water allocation. The project was co-funded by DEFRA and Anglian Water, and it benefited from the support of a steering group where many different organisations, some of which are listed on there, were advising. And it set out to answer the following research question. What is an effective water trading system, and what are the implications for stakeholders concerned with sustainable water abstraction? And the main ambition of the research was to concept test the feasibility of effective water trading at a catchment level and to generate evidence to inform policy in the context of DEFRA's abstraction reform project. So the project was carried out in a specific supply-constrained catchment, which is the Upper Ouse and Bedford Ouse catchment in East Anglia. The catchment was chosen because there are a variety of abstraction types, and also because there were two significant public water supply abstraction points at Bedford, and the major one, which was at Grafham Reservoir, where the water is abstracted from the river and then pumped up to the reservoir and used for public water supply. So the project was conducted in two phases. Phase one was engagement with stakeholders and by focus groups and interviews. And important to note that where this included environmental groups, regulators and the steering group, it also included actual extractors from the catchment. And phase two was a demonstration of different market methods to abstractors and stakeholders to see if they would engage with trading and what it actually meant at catchment level. So phase one findings. Well, a lot of the research was actually conducted during the 2011-2012 drought. So there were some interesting findings in relation to that, and evidence of social capital and collaborative approaches to the management of water, some of which have already been mentioned already. But this is interesting when we think back to a stewardship approach, that it should be collaborative and it engage with different sectors, and we did find some evidence of that. But we also found that the current system is not well understood, and that there was a general agreement that the current system is not flexible enough to deal with future challenges. So during phase two, we trialled two alternative market models with stakeholders and abstractors at an interactive workshop. So the first was improved pairwise trading, and the second, a common pool model. So before I go on to explain what they are, it might be just useful to reflect on the current system and how that works. So the current system is known as pairwise trading. So trading takes place between two license holders. As Henry's already mentioned, the transaction costs are very high. It's quite it can take a long time to trade, because every individual trade needs to be approved by the Environment Agency. And it's also quite difficult to, if you want to buy or sell water, to find somebody to trade with. There are also difficulties establishing the value of water, and people who are potentially interested in trading are put off by the fact that they don't know how much water is worth and how much they should be buying or selling it for. And the current market is very thin, so there have only been 50 trades completed in the last 8 years. And this raises concerns about if you sell your water today, if in the future you need that water, will you be able to buy it back from the market? Will there be any water available for you? So the first potential model that we trialled was an improved pairwise trading system, which is based on the current system but with some improvements. We used a hydroeconomic model to model trading, and then the outputs of which were discussed with participants. So this was focusing on short-term pre-approved trades and using an online bulletin board to help connect buyers and sellers to reduce transaction costs. And the hydroeconomic model was used to assess the performance of three licensing systems, the first of which is the current system with HOFs, or hands off flows. The second was a current system with short-term pre-approved trades. And the third system was a shares licensing system, similar to the one discussed by Henry in the last presentation. So in the shares licensing system, you would be your right would be a proportion of the available water as opposed to a fixed volumetric quantity. So this is an example of what the online bulletin board might look like. And you see coming down the middle is the river. The blobs, different colour blobs on the river, are abstraction points. And the different colours indicate the extent of pre-approval. And those circles, the blobs with the red circles around them, indicate interest in trading. So what the model did essentially was to suggest who might trade with whom, how much they would be prepared to trade, and under what hydrological conditions. And this is showing some of the outputs of the modelling work. So the first graph along the top shows the current water system, and I should just point out that all of these, the flow data that was used came from a very dry year, so this is under very dry conditions, it's not under normal climatic conditions. What the first graph is showing is that the total amount of water abstracted is quite constrained. This is because with the HOF system, with hands-off flow system, when water is above a certain level in the river, you can abstract, and when it falls below this level, you're not entitled to take any of your licence. So it's a very either-or. You can either take your full entitlement or you can take nothing. And what the next two graphs are showing is that when trading is allowed, that there are much more favourable abstraction patterns, because people are able to, the allocation of water is much more efficient. And this slide is looking at what the impacts of trading is on the flows in the catchment during these very dry conditions. So the blue line is current licensing without trading, and the red line, current licensing with trading. And both of these are showing that in a very dry year with the hands-off flows, the environment actually isn't very well protected. Because as soon as flows go above the hands-off flows level, abstractors start abstracting again and taking their full entitlement. And it's only in the shares-based system where the environment actually does have some protection. So what were the reactions to the improved pairwise trading system? Well, the abstractors that attended the workshop were generally quite positive about it. They felt that it was easy to understand because it was built on the current system, and they were quite positive about the online bulletin boards and felt that that might be something that they would be interested in using. So the next system that we trialled was the common pool model. And this was actually an interactive demo that we did with participants. So the common pool model, there are no pairwise trading. Instead, users submit bids to a market manager, and it's a system of auctions. So the market manager uses a hydroeconomic model, which is able to collect all the bids and find the optimal hydrological and economic solution. So the important thing to note with this system is that users do not have a fixed allocation of water, but it is entirely based on a shares-based system. There's no obligation for users to, for abstractors to engage with the system. It's there to top up their water or to sell water if they want to, but they don't have to. And this is some of the outputs of the modelling. And what this is showing is that although it is quite complex trying to find the optimal hydrological and economic solution, it is possible. And the environment is protected because only the water above environmental limits is available for trading. And on this slide, you can show this shows the clearing price of water at different points in the catchment. This is a real positive for traders because one of the barriers to trade is not understanding what the value of water actually is, and this provides really good price transparency. What it also shows is that the value of water varies across the catchment, and this reflects the hydrological reality and water availability. So what were the reactions to the common pool model? Well, it's quite a radical departure to the current system, and it would require a change of mindset from abstractors and regulators together. There were quite a few concerns about the model, I think because it was so different, and the participants at the workshop didn't have very long to familiarise themselves with it. But concerns included the training and the time that would be required to manage the system, particularly for abstractors that are abstracting in multiple catchments. There were concerns from some that if you have an obligation to supply water and you get your bidding strategy wrong and you don't manage to buy enough water, what would that mean? There were quite a lot of concerns about the ability of public water supply to dominate the market. And that requires further investigation. The idea of scaling was not very popular because it was felt to offer less certainty than the current system, although whether that is the case or not requires, again, further investigation. And there were also concerns about potential unintended consequences. So if the value of water was revealed to be quite high at certain times of the year, would that mean that certain sectors were now rendered uneconomic and would go out of business? So one particular concern that came out of the research during both of the phases was the possibility of ring fencing water for agriculture. And this was would be to protect farmers' abstraction rights and to prevent them from being squeezed out of the market by the larger users, such as public water supply. There are some concerns about this, as it might skew the market, as it would keep non-agricultural users out of that part of the market. It could remove resilience from the trading system. And also, crucially, it may inhibit farmers from investing in water storage in partnership with other users. So I think one of the ideas that came out of this work was the possibility of multi-sectoral investment in storage facilities, and ring fencing would probably prohibit this. But a wider debate on the pros and cons of ring fencing for agriculture is needed. So, coming to the end of my presentation now, just thinking about the original question, could trade in water resources promote water stewardship? Well, I think the work showed that trading can protect the environment and other in-stream users, particularly when rights are defined as a share of available water. It also can encourage much more efficient allocation of water. It could encourage investment in infrastructure, and it's much more flexible. But there are concerns about unintended consequences that would be socially undesirable, such as the loss of sector. And also in the collaborative approaches and social capital that I mentioned the research uncovered in the first phase, what the impact of trading would be on that and if it would result in a loss of trust is probably something that needs to be explored further. So possible next steps would be to improve the demo tools and the models. The Common Pool demo could be used as a laboratory to explore some of these issues, particularly the effects of ring fencing and public water supply dominance within the market. There's an ongoing question that we're quite interested in at Anglian Water about to what extent could trading encourage multi-sectoral investment in shared infrastructure. The project could also be extended to other catchments, and if anybody is particularly interested in the research, then we are looking for funding partners.
All donations are gratefully received.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Yep. Okay, our final speaker this morning is John Stern, who is a senior visiting fellow and founder member of the Centre for Competition and Regulatory Policy in the Department of Economics at City University London. He's also a senior advisor at CEPA, Cambridge Economic Policy Associate, and an associate researcher at the Electricity Policy Research Group at Cambridge. John has worked extensively as an economic consultant and has also worked for the UK Government Economic Service. He's a co-author of a very good book on evaluating infrastructure regulatory systems in 2006. And he's the member of various academic panels for utility regulators such as the rail regulator Ofwat and Ofgem. I might say also John is probably the leading voice at the moment in the debate about water trading, I think, in England and Wales in academic circles. So he's very well placed to give this presentation.
Thank you very much. Right, well, I was delighted to be asked about this, to come and talk at this conference. And I had an email exchange with Bettina, and he said, oh, it's about water rights. And so, and that led me to think, well, what do we mean by a water right? Okay, and in some senses, I'm going to agree with quite a lot of what's been said in the previous two presentations, but I'm going to do it from a slightly higher level perspective. I should say that although I've done a lot of work in other utilities, particularly energy and telecoms in developing countries and so on, my talk about water here today is very much about the UK perspective, although kind of clearly informed by what's happened in Western US and Australia and so on. Okay. Now, the people I think who take rights most seriously are moral philosophers, particularly Oxford moral philosophers who kind of have long debates about do rights exist and what are they and so on, lawyers and economists. And it's been very interesting from the first session hearing about the discussion of the legal kind of framework. I think both lawyers and economists will agree that for rights to be meaningful, they must both be defined and enforceable. For economists, the focus is primarily on property rights. And most of my talk is going to be about trading and property rights. We would all say that secure and enforceable property rights are crucial for markets to operate effectively. And secure means they can be changed, but they have to be changed predictably with due process and so on, and not create uncertainty. Now, one of the questions arises in terms of what do we mean by the market. In this case, I'm going to think about private buyers and sellers of water of various kinds. But of course, this is a market where there are major externalities, things that aren't taken account of in the market transaction. In particular, that we've had a discussion about water for the environment. And that, I take it, is what is meant by sustainability and so on. Will there still be trout in the River Test? Will the River Test still exist if there's sufficient over-abstraction? And so it is these externalities that create the need for legal and regulatory controls of some kinds, but also, I think, particularly in the climate change context, lead to much more discussion about the need for trading. Okay. Now, moving on, I think when people talk about markets, mainly non-economists think of a market as being a set of spot trades. So you go to the shop and you buy a pair of shoes, or you go to Oxford Market and buy some vegetables or something. And in fact, most market transactions, and virtually all business-to-business market transactions, are carried out by contract. And many of these contracts are very long. Typically a company, I'm sure Anglia Water, has a spectrum of contracts with its various purchase people whom it's purchasing or to whom it's selling, which are a spectrum of durations. The point about if there are contracts, the question then arises about the nature of those contracts and whether or not those contracts encourage technical progress and investment. And kind of the word investment has cropped up various times. I'm going to talk about this. Now, one of the main developments in economics over the last 30, 40 years has been the emergence of what's called the new industrial economics literature, which discusses a lot the question of the conditions necessary for long-term contracts to exist and their relationship with secure and enforceable property rights. Now, one of the things that I put up on the slide, beginning of the discussion this morning, I want to spend a bit more time on, is that these property rights do not need to be individually owned. You can have collective property rights. And you can have informal sharing or so on. We were told this morning about the Lincolnshire Water Exchange and so on. Fisheries has been mentioned, and New Zealand fisheries crops up in this. Actually, collective ownership in the New Zealand fisheries, originally they defined share catches for particular fisheries in terms of levels, and that was a disaster. And so they then moved towards having the fisheries being declared, and each fisherman could own in perpetuity a share of that pool. That share was perfectly tradable, and so on. Each year, the government would say the share is 1,000. So much, 1,000 tons of fish, or they didn't spawn last year, so it's 20. And so the shares come up. Now, that all sounds great, and everyone in the first session this morning was very keen about this in terms of collectivity and so on, but no one mentioned the word free rider. Okay. And the point that I would make is that these schemes can work very well if it's a small number of people with strong collective interests and strong collective sanctions. But once the schemes get beyond a certain point, and once outsiders come in, we're told about quarry tenants and so on, then free rider issues get important. And I think from Alice's last presentation, one of the questions about bidding is if these pools get a bit bigger, you'll get strategic behaviour in the auctions. Okay, so these collective property ownership issues, you have to be quite careful with them. For those who want to know rather more, I'm afraid I got the name wrong. It should be Eleanor Ostrom, with an M, not a Y, who's written some incredibly interesting stuff in this area. But the person from whom I learned most was an economic historian and game theorist, Avner Greif, G-R-E-I-F, who talked about how collective trading mechanisms from the Berber North African tradesmen evolved, you know, and they didn't generalise as we got economic growth. Okay, so what do we mean about water rights? Well, retail water customers have rights of various kinds, and these are very important for social and health issues. I'm not going to discuss those further here today, and on the whole, that's not the theme of the workshop. What I'm going to talk about is wholesale market trades, alternatively known as upstream water, and that involves water companies and others buying and selling water to one another, and primarily to one another. And in the UK and other types of other OECD countries, there are two types of wholesale water trade. There's trade in abstraction licenses, and there's trade in bulk water. Okay. Virtually all of the discussion we've had here today, including 97% of what Henry was talking about, with licensed trade, which takes place within a catchment area. I'm actually rather more interested in bulk water trade. I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. Okay, let's go back to property rights. Some people in this room, when I was beginning to think about this presentation, had an email from me saying, well, this is all very interesting, but who owns the water? Okay, which I'm going to come to in a second. Now, what's quite clear is that there are some ownership property rights around, and these are abstraction licences. Okay, we've heard a lot about abstraction licences in their reform, and in the UK they're issued by and enforced by the Environment Agency in England and Wales, and SEPA in Scotland, the other SEPA. And these abstraction rights do provide a clear property right, and they're owned by companies, and they allow wholesale and retail sales of the water according to Ofwat supply licences. But who owns the water to which the abstraction licences are attached? Well, we heard in the very first talk about riparian rights, which I take to be as a reasonable use rights. You know, can you fish from it? Can you take a little bit of water to put on in your pond or whatever? But are not associated with the buying and selling of water. I think that if you have some underground water on your land, you own it and you can do it. It gets more complicated if it straddles with some more boundaries. But these abstraction rights have been closely linked, and as I understand it, historically have been grandfathered with the riparian rights. But they've also developed independently as the public water supply companies have come up. Okay. Now, in a sense, the question who owns the water is such a difficult one is that effectively it's been a commons good. Fisheries in international waters are a commons the air is a commons, and so on. But there has been a whole literature called the tragedy of the commons, and the tragedy of the commons is where supply shortages emerge, where there's excess demand arises, then the commons breaks down. And you see that historically with peasants making greater use of cutting down more trees and destroying commonly owned forests and so on and so forth. And so you get enclosures. And so the commons system breaks down when supply shortages emerge. Now, people have been saying quite rightly that, oh, it's always raining in Britain. And so, and that has given us a perspective that we are a water surplus country. And indeed, I guess until 20, 30 years ago, pretty much almost everywhere, we were. There were some particular shortage areas, but they were very limited. But assuming that climate change continues and gives this extensive pressure, then the shortages will increasingly arise. And that gives the problem about ensuring enough water availability both for the human uses and for the environment. We already have, as has been said, quite large parts of the country either over-abstracted or over-licensed. And this is the diagram. Anyone who's ever been to a talk of mine knows on water knows that this is the thing that was bound to come up. Okay, and the areas in blue are the ones where there is surplus water even at low flow. And the redder, darker and redder ones are the ones, the darkest red are the over-abstracted, and we've got the over-licensed kind of intermediate ones. And what you will see from this map is, firstly, the vast majority of the over-abstracted areas are in the south and southeast, but there are some blue bits too. And there are others, and it's the further north and west you go, there is not excess demand. Any economist who's done economics 101, or at least economics of trade, looks at this and says, gains from trade. There have to be gains from trade. So running water supply industry is a series of autarkic or semi-autarkic bodies just makes no sense. Okay. Question is, how do you encourage those trades and what kinds of trades? Now, the licensed trading can exist broadly within river basins or joined up catchments or whatever, but you can't have licensed trading does nothing very much to get water from there to water down there. For that, you have to have bulk water trading. Okay? And so, most of my work is saying, well, what do you need to do to enable to do that? There are a lot of other things you need, although abstraction, scarcity-based abstraction, pricing, or the equivalent, and I think for Inarte, it's a crucial element. Okay. Now, there has actually historically been. It's all about the one thing I will say about abstraction licenses and so on. Beyond that, is that the trade in licenses does kind of morph into trade in bulk water, because if you get very short duration license trades, like in the summer or so on, it's effectively a bulk water trade. So there are those kind of similarities. And you do also get formal as well as informal arrangements. I've heard in the prime growers of Rhone wines are worried that because of climate change, the terroir for best herbitage is declining, so they have informal arrangements with the farmers around to make sure they have enough water to ensure that their wines continue getting 90 plus marks out of 100 in Robert Parker. But I'm going to spend a little bit of time on the traded bulk water. This accounts for 4 to 5% of delivered water in England and Wales. And in England and Wales, virtually all of that are very long established raw water trades. Most famous is the Elan Valley to Birmingham. There's also one in the Yorkshire Ouse. But in the southeast, the volume of trade is rather larger. I came up with a figure of 8% within the southeast, and much more of that is treated and potable water. Now, going back to this map, the question of how you get water from the far northwest into the southeast is a question of can you do things through interconnection? And the kind of mental model that I have asked whether it is transferable to the UK is the EU gas market, where you build, it's not that you build one socking great water pipe from Kielder to Oxford, but you reinforce the pipes going from Kielder down across the thing. You probably need to say one side or other of the Pennines, and so on. Right. Now, where there is significant excess demand for water, and so the commons are no longer sustainable, we need some form of rationing. Okay. Some kind of design. How does how do social and economic systems do rationing? One version is just by quantity, central allocation. Farmers get this much, breweries get that much. The alternative is to do it by price. In fact, and particularly in water, we already, to some extent, have some price elements and there is some quantity controls. And all of the trading stuff is how do we expand the market and how do we bring in price rather more, but with quantity controls for essential uses, or, you know, they may get suspended in an extreme drought or whatever. Now, central allocation locates water rights in state. I don't think anyone has proposed that this system should be adopted in the UK. I think this would be environment agency becomes GOS plan. Unfortunately, that is extremely unlikely to happen. So we're looking towards market solutions, and these market solutions are about creating property rights in water. What it does is it commodifies water ownership and use. And that's similar to what's happened in energy, where in air we talk about an analogous situation has arisen in terms of emission limits. And this requires kind of reform to abstraction licenses. It also promotes bulk water trade to some extent, and I'll say a bit more. So, not surprisingly, the license reform in England and Wales has been focused on abstraction licences. I will anticipate a bit and say that I had come independently from the New Zealand fishery model to advocating the shares thing that Henry talked about. But it's worth saying a bit more why the pure abstraction pricing doesn't work. The first is it's unpopular because it feeds directly into wholesale and retail bills, and that creates a problem given public health externalities. It also doesn't address the problem of existing and potential excess water use from over-licensing and over-abstraction. And all the price responses, demand response, even supply responses to changes in price are low, except in the very long term. So that's why I think the shares model works. And I point to the bottom one on that slide, which has that the prices emerge from the demand and supply and observed trade transactions rather than the government agency having to set them in advance. If you said to the environment agency, tell us what is the vector of abstraction prices going to be across the country, and if they had any sense, how the hell would we know? Okay. Now, how does this feed back into the ownership of water? Well, it basically separates the link between ownership of the water and water use. The riparian rights, it seems to me, can continue for fishing and cultivating water plants, but the links to irrigation and commercial use of water, other than tiny ones, gets broken. Water commons are greatly restricted. I mean, you can argue that some of the kind of collective ownership we've talked about is a sort of market version of a recreation of commons, but I think that's stretching things a bit too much. And the water share abstraction mechanism, what it does is it commodifies the use of water while ensuring sufficient water for the environment. So the ownership, as I understand it, my knowledge of the legal aspects of this is kind of asymptotically approaching zero. Ownership of the water, in the sense of rivers and so on, can continue on the current basis, but the rights associated with it from these reforms are greatly reduced and are commoditized, but are commoditized on the basis of environmentally based resource pricing. I think that's it. Yes, that's it.
Excellent.
Thank you very much, Sean. We have exactly 15 minutes for any questions that people have, so I think as our speakers come up, we'll take some questions.